smoking is associated with coronary heart disease. Nowadays, this disease accounts for a high percentage of deaths annually. Cigarette smokers are much more likely to die from a heart attack than non-smokers. Smoking injures blood vessels, speeds up hardening of the arteries, and increases the work of the heart. It is one of the factors contributing to high blood pressure. What little we've mentioned above is sufficient to show that smoking is extremely harmful to health. Most people throughout the world have come to realize the danger. Nowadays, some governments are taking practical measures against smoking. We sincerely advise those who have formed the smoking habit to stop, and those who haven't yet started, not to. It is both for your own sake and for the sake of the next generation. A recent survey report says that children exposed to parental cigarette smoke may be put at a higher risk of developing lung disease later in their lives. Passive exposure to smoke may also interfere with normal lung growth in young children. There is a strong association between parental smoking and children's pulmonary function. Children who recorded the weakest lung function were found to be smokers themselves, and to have parents or brothers and sisters who smoked. So let us join together to launch a mass movement to break this harmful smoking habit, and build ourselves up, healthy and strong, to work hard for the four modernizations.
6. Call to stop offering cigarettes. To the Chinese, who claim to have invented rules of etiquette, offering cigarettes is a way of being hospitable to guests. When somebody calls, first of all, the host would offer him a cigarette and a cup of tea. In the countryside, hospitable old men often allow visiting guests to share the long-stemmed Chinese pipe which they themselves are smoking. At wedding ceremonies, brides would offer cigarettes to all guests who came to express their congratulations and light the cigarettes for each of them, one after another. All these were originally aimed at displaying the Chinese hospitality and respect towards the guests. But in recent years, the old tradition has been used as a means to nurse good relations. Even those who never smoke have brand name cigarettes in their pockets. Whenever they have to seek somebody's favor, they first offer him a cigarette. If the other party turns it down, he is being impolite. If he accepts it, he has to do something, for courtesy demands a favor in return. Tobacco contains harmful substances, so offering cigarettes to somebody is equal to doing harm to him. But neither people who offer cigarettes nor those who take them fully realize it. It is even more unhealthy for the host to pass the long-stemmed Chinese pipe or water pipe to the visitor after smoking it beforehand. Once, I paid a visit to a relative who had just returned from abroad. He was smoking, but did not produce one for me. Instead, he placed the cigarette packet on the table and told me, "Cigarettes produce carbon monoxide and nicotine. But if you don't mind this, take it yourself." His way of offering cigarettes was unique, but worth learning. Many people throughout the world are attempting to quit smoking. But to give up the practice, firstly, I think, we had better change the traditional method of entertaining guests. Not to offer cigarettes does not mean one is inhospitable. The cigarette packet is on the table. If you cannot check your craving for one, at the risk of your health, you may. But you will have to bear the consequences yourself. You had better also bear in mind that while you are smoking and harming yourself, you are also polluting the air and hurting others.
7. Smoking is a bad habit. Smoking is a bad habit. Firstly, it ruins people's health. Health experts have warned us for years that smoking can lead to heart disease, lung cancer, and various respiratory ailments. The World Health Organization says diseases linked to smoking kill at least 2.5 million people each year. Research conducted in many countries also indicates that pregnant women who smoke run the risk of having deformed babies. Besides, it has been proven beyond doubt that when a person smokes, he subjects the people around him not only to great discomfort, but also to physical harm. Secondly, smoking is extravagant. Smokers, either wage earners or those who live off their parents, spend a large sum of money on cigarettes, which cost them at least 10% of their expenses each month. What's more, sensible women try to avoid marrying heavy smokers, even though some of them appreciate the image of a handsome young man with a cigarette dangling from the corner of his mouth. A friend of mine, a heavy smoker, has been seeking an ideal wife who will tolerate his extravagant hobby, but up to now he hasn't found one. Thirdly, smoking has a bad impact on the psyche of the smokers. After realizing the bad effects of smoking, many people try to give up smoking. But no matter how hard they try, some of them just can't resist the temptation to smoke again. Gradually, they lose confidence in themselves and get used to making excuses.
Lesson 16. Is money the most important thing in life? Text. The only thing people are interested in today is earning more money. Once upon a time, there lived a beautiful young woman and a handsome young man. They were very poor, but as they were deeply in love, they wanted to get married. The young people's parents shook their heads. "You can't get married yet," they said. "Wait till you get a good job with good prospects." So the young people waited until they found good jobs with good prospects, and they were able to get married. They were still poor, of course. They didn't have a house to live in or any furniture, but that didn't matter. The young man had a good job with good prospects. So large organizations lent him the money he needed to buy a house, some furniture, all the latest electrical appliances, and a car. The couple lived happily ever after, paying off debts for the rest of their lives. And so ends another modern romantic fable. We live in a materialistic society. and are trained from our earliest years to be acquisitive. Our possessions, mine and yours, are clearly labelled from early childhood. When we grow old enough to earn a living, it does not surprise us to discover that success is measured in terms of the money you earn. We spend the whole of our lives keeping up with our neighbours, the Joneses. If we buy a new television set, Jones is bound to buy a bigger and better one. If we buy a new car, we can be sure that Jones will go one better and get two new cars, one for his wife and one for himself. The most amusing thing about this game is that the Joneses and all the neighbours who are struggling frantically to keep up with them are spending borrowed money, kindly provided, at a suitable rate of interest, of course, by friendly banks, insurance companies, etc. It is not only in affluent societies that people are obsessed with the idea of making more money. Consumer goods are desirable everywhere, and modern industry deliberately sets out to create new markets. Gone are the days when industrial goods were made to last forever. The wheels of industry must be kept turning. Built-in obsolescence provides the means. Goods are made to be discarded. Cars get tinnier and tinnier. You no sooner acquire this year's model than you are thinking about its replacement. This materialistic outlook has seriously influenced education. Fewer and fewer young people these days acquire knowledge only for its own sake. Every course of studies must lead somewhere, i.e., to a bigger wage packet. The demand for skilled personnel far exceeds the supply, and big companies compete with each other to recruit students before they have completed their studies. Tempting salaries and fringe benefits are offered to them. Recruiting tactics of this kind have led to the brain drain, the process by which highly skilled people offer their services to the highest bidder. The wealthier nations deprive their poorer neighbours of their most able citizens. While mammon is worshipped as never before, the rich get richer and the poor poorer.
2. Read. Read the following passages. Underline the important viewpoints while reading. 1. Wealth led to disaster. In all American history, there is no story stranger than that of John A. Sutter. We have read about the early history of San Francisco. When the independence of California was declared in 1846, San Francisco was a small town of some 800 inhabitants. Then, in 1848, gold was discovered on land not far away. This land was owned by John A. Sutter. Immediately, there was a vast movement of people, not only from the United States, but from other parts of the world, toward San Francisco and the gold fields. This was the famous gold rush of 1849. San Francisco grew to three times its size in just a few weeks. Within a year, it had a population of over 25,000 people. Previously a quiet, pleasant town, San Francisco was changed almost overnight into a rough and crowded city. full of all kinds of adventurers and other strange characters. The same factors that operated to change San Francisco also changed the life of John A. Sutter in an equally extreme form. John A. Sutter was a citizen of Switzerland. He had come, penniless, in the spirit of adventure to the United States. He lived and worked for a time in Pennsylvania and finally settled in California in 1839, when still a young man of 36. He obtained the rights from the Mexican government to a large tract of land in the present area of Sacramento, some 70 miles north of San Francisco on the Sacramento River. Here, Sutter established his own private colony. This colony he named New Helvetia. Sutter was an intelligent, well-educated man. He built a fort inside which he established a large trading post. He planted great numbers of fruit trees along the banks of the Sacramento River, as well as hundreds of acres of wheat. He became a very rich man by providing most of the ships that came to the harbor of San Francisco with supplies, both for their own use and for export. Sutter had thousands of cattle and horses on his many acres. 500 men, mostly Mexicans and Indians, worked regularly for him. He wrote to his wife and three sons, whom he had left in Switzerland, asking them to come and live with him and enjoy his great success. Then in 1848, gold was discovered on Sutter's land. He was building a sawmill some distance from his fort. Here, in a stream leading from the mill, one of Sutter's workmen found some pieces of gold. At first, Sutter tried to keep the news quiet. He had dreams of becoming even richer than he already was, perhaps the richest man in the whole world. But within a few weeks, the news about the gold leaked out. Men descended upon Sutter's land from all directions. Soon they were coming from all over the United States, and even from more distant places. These people moved into the area like a great herd of animals. They killed all of Sutter's cattle, stole his farm produce and tools, and tore down his buildings to obtain wood to build homes for themselves. The city of Sacramento sprang up where Sutter's fort stood. On the site of his sawmill grew up the present city of Coloma. Far from becoming the richest man in the world, as he had dreamed, Sutter was reduced to poverty. He finally moved away from the area to a distant part of his land. Here, his family arrived to live with him. He began to farm and, with his sons, planted more fruit trees and new fields of wheat. Again, he was fairly successful. In 1855, Sutter brought a suit in the California courts against the 1,700 settlers, who now occupied the land he had previously owned. He demanded $25 million from the state for the roads, canals, and bridges that he himself had built, but which the state had taken over. He also asked for a percentage of all the gold mined on his property. This suit was decided by the Californian courts in Sutter's favor. Briefly, Sutter was again a rich and important man. His dream of a private empire with himself as king and ruler, returned. But then the storm broke again. When the judge's decision was made public, 10,000 people, who were now established in the area and thought they might lose their homes, descended upon the court. They burned the courthouse and tried to hang the judge. They destroyed more of Sutter's property. Later, Sutter's home was set on fire and burned to the ground. Sutter's oldest son killed himself. His second son was murdered. Sutter was never able to recover from these last and final blows. He went back east and, in the courts of Washington, again brought a suit to recover what he claimed had been stolen from him. He spent the last 15 years of his life in this sad manner. Tirelessly, he went from senator to congressman, from one government office to another. Friends tried to help him, and he received various honors in recognition of his early work in California. But delay followed delay, both in Congress and in the government courts. The General, as he came to be called, died alone in a small Washington hotel room, a broken and bitter man.
2. What did Qigong do with his money? Everyone knows how important money is in the world today. But what did Qigong do with his hard-earned 1.5 million yuan? Mr. Qigong, aged 79, is a well-known calligrapher in China. He became famous the hard way. Born in a poor family, he did not have much schooling until his talent attracted the attention of Professor Chen Yuan, the president of Furan University. For years, Professor Chen took him under his personal care and taught him literature and calligraphy. Professor Chen thought highly of Qigong and helped him to find jobs of teaching at several institutions. Years of hard work made Qigong an excellent teacher, an outstanding calligrapher and painter. In memory of his teacher, Professor Chen Yuan, Qigong decided in 1991 to set up a foundation to give awards to both teachers and students who excel in their work. Qigong worked day after day at his desk and produced more than 100 works of calligraphy, which he sold for 1,630,000 yuan. All this money went into the foundation which was named after his teacher. He did not leave a penny for himself. What do you think money means to Qigong?
3. Pop stars live like the royalty. Pop stars today enjoy a style of living which was once the prerogative only of royalty. Wherever they go, people turn out in their thousands to greet them. The crowds go wild, trying to catch a brief glimpse of their smiling, colorfully dressed idols. The stars are transported in their chauffeur-driven Rolls-Royces, private helicopters, or executive aeroplanes. They are surrounded by a permanent entourage of managers, press agents, and bodyguards. Photographs of them appear regularly in the press, and all their comings and goings are reported, for, like royalty, pop stars are news. If they enjoy many of the privileges of royalty, they certainly share many of the inconveniences as well. It is dangerous for them to make unscheduled appearances in public. They must be constantly shielded from the adoring crowds which idolize them. They are no longer private individuals, but public property. The financial rewards they receive for this sacrifice cannot be calculated, for their rates of pay are astronomical. And why not? Society has always rewarded its top entertainers lavishly. The great days of Hollywood have become legendary. Famous stars enjoyed fame, wealth, and adulation on an unprecedented scale. By today's standards, the excesses of Hollywood do not seem quite so spectacular. A single gramophone record nowadays may earn much more in royalties than the films of the past ever did. The competition for the title Top of the Pops is fierce, but the rewards are truly colossal.
4. Pop stars certainly earn their money. It is only right that the stars should be paid in this way. Don't the top men in industry earn enormous salaries for the services they perform to their companies and their countries? Pop stars earn vast sums in foreign currency, often more than large industrial concerns, and the taxman can only be grateful for their massive annual contributions to the exchequer. So who would begrudge them their rewards? It's all very well for people in humdrum jobs to moan about the successes and rewards of others. People who make envious remarks should remember that the most famous stars represent only the tip of the iceberg. For every famous star, there are hundreds of others struggling to earn a living. A man working in a steady job and looking forward to a pension at the end of it has no right to expect very high rewards. He has chosen security and peace of mind, so there will always be a limit to what he can earn. But a man who attempts to become a star is taking enormous risks. He knows at the outset that only a handful of competitors ever get to the very top. He knows that years of concentrated effort may be rewarded with complete failure. But he knows, too, that the rewards for success are very high indeed. They are the recompense for the huge risks involved. And if he achieves them, he has certainly earned them. That's the essence of private enterprise.